One difficulty that people sometimes raise is, what about those who don't know there is a God? Surely it's not fair that God would judge people on what they don't know about. The passage that we're looking at tonight doesn't give a comprehensive answer to that, and indeed Scripture doesn't fully unpack that question for us. But what it does make clear is that it is possible. Indeed, it is obvious to know that there is something behind all of creation. This section follows from Paul's teaching in the first part of the chapter about the power of the gospel. And that section deals with the gospel being revealed. We move from the gospel being revealed to the wrath of God being revealed. Verse 18 is God's charge against humans. And then verses 19 to 32 are the unfolding of that charge. And so in verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. There's so much about this section of Scripture that makes us feel uncomfortable. In and of itself, that's perhaps not a bad thing, so long as we allow ourselves to be disturbed by the text and we act on that disturbance rather than trying to explain away the things that make us uncomfortable. The first thing that we find uncomfortable is the idea of the wrath of God. So perhaps it's helpful to unpack what's meant by God's wrath. God's wrath is his negative judgment. It's his settled fury against sin. It's not a kind of capricious outburst, a losing of the temper that's uncontrolled, but it's a settled anger that's consistent and that's rooted in God's justice. Sometimes it's said, how can a God of wrath be a God of love? But it's been pointed out that actually the opposite of God's wrath is not his love, but the opposite of God's wrath would be neutrality about good and evil, a kind of apathy about whether something is good and something is evil. And God certainly isn't apathetic about justice and injustice, about good and evil. We're then told that God's wrath is revealed against people who ignore him. And Paul is here making the case that the world itself, the world round about us, tells us there is a God. One of the things that people are often searching for is, what caused that? What's behind that? And the fact that everything seems to have a prior cause suggests that there is someone behind it all. That's partly what science is investigating. What is behind this? And that's another area that goes against the grain in our culture. We're used to the idea, or at least we're regularly told, that science is against God. And subconsciously, the idea is communicated that we're just one or two knockdown arguments away from science abolishing the idea of God altogether. To fall for that idea is actually to go against the history of science, and indeed the number of modern scientists who testify that it's precisely because of the wonder of the world around about them that they are believers. In terms of the history of science, the first hypothesis of the first modern scientists was that if a rational God made the universe and gave humans an intelligence that echoed his own, well, perhaps his image-bearing creatures would be able to discern the laws behind the world that he had made, would be able to work out the order and the pattern in this world. And so here, Paul is telling his readers what the psalmists regularly declared, that the universe tells us there's a creator. The evidence is there for people who open their minds that there must be someone out there. And therefore, the onus is in humans to find out what that creator is like and what duties we owe to the creator, what he expects of us, and how we're meant to relate to him. But God's wrath is revealed because humans go the opposite way. And they suppress that voice that nags away. That voice that says, oh, this can't all be random. They suppress. And so try and shut out the idea of God. And God lets us have what we want. The consequence of shutting out the voice that says, surely there is. Surely there's somebody out there. Surely there's something behind all of this, is that ultimately you become closed to the idea that there is someone behind that. And so in this chapter, as a result of humans suppressing the idea that there is a God, an exchange takes place. We may have heard in theological terms of the glorious exchange, where Christ takes on our sin, we take on his righteousness. But in this chapter, we have a kind of inglorious exchange, where we exchange the worship of the Creator for the worship of the things that he have created. Ultimately, we're all made to worship something. And if we don't worship the Creator, well, it makes sense that then we have to find something else to worship. We'll worship the things that the Creator has made. David Wallace was an American novelist who died about a decade ago. And he influenced some of the modern American novelists, people like Jonathan Franzen and folks like that. I'm not sure where he was at in relation to God, but he thought in philosophical terms about a lot of things. And here's something he said in a lecture. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some other infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much everything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you'll die a million deaths before they finally plant you. And so you see, the danger of worshipping what God has created rather than the Creator. It eats you up. And so the remainder of the chapter, from verse 24 on, spells out the consequences of shutting out God. And the phrase, "give them over," occurs three times in the remainder of the chapter. The lists that come from verse 24 on aren't the primary root of the sin, but they are the symptoms of the main sin. The main sin is to shut out God and find something else to worship. The results of the main sin, well, they are the list that's spelled out. And so verses 24 and 25 talks about a general handing over to debauchery, where Paul points out how, as a result of quashing any desire to acknowledge or to find out about God, sinful humans are handed over to the things that they have embraced. The truth of God, that's exchanged for a lie. Created things, they're worshipped rather than the Creator. And so, what are we given over to? Verses 26 and 27 make the point that those who shut out God have exchanged God's plans for sex for something else. And so God has handed them over to these things. These verses are amongst the verses which are always debated when it comes to debates about same-sex relationships. I'm not going to go into the nuances of that debate here because the chapter is not primarily about sexual relationships, but about the need to worship God. But I'm happy to discuss it afterwards if you want to. But what I will say is that I find it difficult to find any other reading in these verses other than same-sex relationships aren't part of God's good plan and are something that have been exchanged for what God originally intended. Relationships which weren't part of God's good plan for the world are one consequence of a world which squashes the idea of God, which says, no, we don't want to worship. And so God says, have it your own way. Here's what it looks like. The third handing over comes in verse 28. They didn't think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind so that they do what ought not to be done. In verse 29 to the first part of verse 31, Paul gives 21 examples of what a depraved mind produces. It's an unappealing list. It's kind of describes the worst of everybody. And indeed, the fact that you could read that list to anyone, whether they're a believer or not, and if you read it to them and left God out of the equation, they would still say, ugh, I don't want to be like that. That suggests, of course we're made in the image of God, because we despise the same thing that God despises. That's part of the evidence, that we're made in His image. And people would say, yeah, of course, those things deserve judgment. And God says, yes, I agree with you. You see, Paul is unpacking. On the one hand, it's evident there is a God. On the other hand, if you shut out God, this is what a world without God looks like. And God will give you what you want. That's what happens whenever any community, whenever any individual, whenever any nation, whenever the world loses its moorings in God. He says, here's what it looks like. Have it your own way. Is it a pretty picture? No. Why are you surprised? Verse 18, pointed to the wrath of God being revealed here and now in a world which abandoned him. And verse 32 takes that forward to God's final judgment. What do these things deserve? They deserve death. I've said before that this is a deeply uncomfortable passage of Scripture. It's bleak. It paints a very bleak picture of humanity. It paints a very bleak picture of a humanity who choose to live without God. If you talk about light and shade, well, it's all shade in this passage. Indeed, the chapters which come, which are the first three chapters or so of Romans, are all in this tenor. Why? Why does Paul write in such bleak terms? Well, ultimately, Romans is about showing us the beauty of God's grace. But we'll only be able to see the beauty of God's grace when we have faced up to the bleakness of a life without God and without his grace. And so he deliberately paints an unattractive picture of humanity because he wants us to see how desperately we need God's mercy, how desperately we need his forgiveness. When we have a serious illness, we need to hear the bad news in all its detail so that we're willing to take on whatever horrible treatment is necessary to make it better. We need to embrace a cure, even if that cure at times seems difficult. And Jesus told us, anyone who doesn't deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me, can't be my disciple. And you think, why would anybody go for that? But then you see, aha, but without Jesus, without God, this is what it looks like. This is the world that you're stuck in. And you need the grace of God to get out of that. We shouldn't be surprised when a society which says that it's got no need for God looks like a mess. God said, that's the way it is. I told you. It's in my word. And if people say, but how do we know there's a God? How can we know there's a God? God says, open your mind. Stop trying to quash God out of the picture. Because when we do, the result is desperate. The result is bleak. The result is a world without light. A world that, in this chapter, seems unremittingly bleak. And the only way to understand the beauty of the grace of God is when we face up to the bleakness of a world which shuts him out. Let's come to him in prayer.